Welcome to the Inspirati, presented by Nuvo. I'm Alex Merrill, and for season two, I am thrilled to be teaming up with Canada's authority on the exceptional, Nuvo Magazine, to showcase a collection of international creative luminaries who are sculpting, welding, crafting, and forging a path forward with originality and finesse. We share these intimate conversations to shine a light on risks taken, guts trusted, hunches explored. We share them with the hope that they will ignite something in you. The Inspirati was created for those seeking inspiration and those seeking to inspire. Please enjoy. If you hold the belief that the artist, by definition, lacks structure, discipline, or business sense, you really need to know Sebastian Arazuriz. Raised by a stoic kindergarten teacher mother as one of four boys, the high testosterone level in his home was contrasted by a massive appreciation for creativity. His art professor father, a man who would be moved to tears when conducting imaginary orchestras, created the arts program that children in Santiago, Chile learn from age 5 to 18. As his guinea pig, Sebastian's childhood was marked by the kind of rigorous training in the arts that is usually reserved for star athletes or aspiring concert pianists. Sebastian studied in a time when art and design were as separated as ideologies as they were sections in his school library. But the career he has built in the years since harmonizes these two disciplines with ingenuity and grace. This is a man who constructs works based on ideas, not aesthetics, and who believes there is no point in creating something that already exists. Instead, he aims to provoke you to see a familiar object differently, thanks to its imaginative design. Stories of Sebastian's university and job interviews shed light on a rare kind of drive. Before he was 30, he became the second living South American artist to have his work auctioned within a Sotheby's sale of important 20th century design. He is recognized for public art installations around the world, from Chile's National Stadium to New York's Times Square, works that aim to arouse new perspectives and conversations about society's relationship with technology, immigrant labor, or religious extremism. Sebastian's dedication to excellence on a daily basis is interwoven with a fierce devotion to a macro perspective on living life like a story you one day would be proud to narrate, that you will believe was worth living. This requires a lack of compromise to self, to integrity, and to courage. During our conversation recorded last winter while in quarantine upon arrival in Santiago, Sebastian reflected on speaking art as a first language, why the art world compels its superstars to lie, how his creative process sometimes reminds him of other climaxes, and why you should never ask and always offer. I hope you learn as much from our conversation as I did, and that it inspires you to reach higher, build bigger, and leave the door open for others. Were you raised in Santiago specifically or somewhere else?
Yeah, I was raised between Santiago and London.
Okay.
So my father was an art professor who basically wrote the entire art program kids learn in Santiago from kindergarten to 18.
Wow.
And I was the guinea pig he basically tested everything on. And I guess as a result, I'm this kind of extremely obsessive, incredibly anal, self-demanding, competitive person that now considers the arts almost as a religion.
Right.
So I think he fucked me up as much as he also like just endowed me with the best education anyone could aspire to have.
Right. Does that make you kind of feel like there's too much democracy in art now, like when we're handing out participation medals for everything, having grown up that way?
I mean, I believe the arts, like every other discipline, are a discipline. Mm. And as such, first and foremost, require of that word to be a part of the practice. Mm-hmm. Right? They require discipline to be part of it. And I think the arts are measurable. The fact that we don't yet have a universal, established, common system of metrics with which we can decide if an artwork is good or not doesn't mean that it isn't measurable. And so obviously, if you get a head start, it's kind of like getting a head start in Olympic gymnastics or in being a concert pianist. And so if you're David Beckham and you're kicking a football that is drenched in paint in order to generate a little Christmas tree shape that's going to be presented in Art Basel, it doesn't quite qualify.
I think I just saw that on your Instagram.
Yeah.
Did I just see that on your Instagram?
Yeah, exactly. So like, I don't know, we should have standards. And it's fine for each author to find their own audience. Mm-hmm. But I think we also want to continue to learn and understand what is possible.
Yeah, and I guess that means an education of the audience as much as an education of the artist.
Yeah, which is very tricky because no one wants to be educated.
Right.
And no one wants to learn and no one wants a preacher. Mm-hmm. I guess it's how do you invite people to start realizing that there are certain things that actually matter.
Right.
And that it's in all of our best interest to incorporate them as part of our creative practice.
Yeah. I started following you on Instagram a while ago because I love classical sculpture and you've incorporated it into your work in such a beautiful way. But while I was researching for this interview, I heard you say in another interview a few years ago, I don't do pretty stuff.
Sure.
Were you making a distinction between pretty and beautiful there? Because your work is so beautiful.
Thank you so much. No, I wasn't thinking of pretty as the diminutive version of beautiful. I was just, I work based on ideas, not based on aesthetics. So the aesthetics come later, right? It's like, I feel first and foremost that if you're creating something, it should be as original as possible. Mm-hmm. And then it should be as concrete as possible. I think it's harder to come up with an original observation that is very, very specific, that you can almost narrate it like a story to someone else. And that person who maybe hasn't seen that artwork could paint a picture in their own minds and be like, oh, that's interesting. I could see the value in that, right? The way you execute it, hopefully, is beautiful. And hopefully that beauty is related to balance and compositions and other elements, and maybe not so much the trends.
Right.
If in fashion today, the trendy thing is to use a triple XL size suits that make you look like you're a toddler inside your father's suit. Sure, that's maybe pretty or beautiful within the current trend.
Right.
But maybe not so much within composition unless we're sort of paralleling that to some sort of a Baroque version of it or so on. So it's kind of like, let's cut to what's the substance? Mm. Why are we doing these things? And if all those things are there, we're at the end, yeah, let's also tweak the final little details, make this as aesthetically appealing as possible.
So within that, where are your thoughts on the relationship between art and design and the titles of artist versus designer? That's something that you maybe don't think about as much now.
I used to struggle a lot with it because I'm old enough to have been told to go to the library when we were studying in school instead of just Googling. And in the library, all the materials were divided by aisles. So all the books that were in the Isle of Architecture were separated from the Isle of Art and the Isle of Design. And the kids wouldn't even mix. The students would be of different practices, almost as being of different ideologies or religions. And if you were doing art, you weren't supposed to do architecture. And if you're doing architecture, you weren't supposed to do design. And even within those, there was hierarchies, right? So architecture was at the very top, and then maybe art and maybe design was the bottom one. So wanting to do both, or feeling I had learned both, I kept resisting this idea that people didn't want you to do multiple things, that they felt if you did multiple things, you weren't serious enough. You were confused.
Yeah, you're a dilettante.
Yeah. So I arrived on a very simple idea, the idea of each discipline being a language. And so you're Canadian, you probably speak French.
A little bit, yeah.
Right. And yeah, plus you have English. And yeah, but I mean, I'm sure that if you're speaking with someone else who also shares the same two languages, and if you're missing one particular word that would help you describe in a more efficient manner what you're trying to communicate, you could just switch and borrow that word.
Oh, that's such an interesting way of putting it.
So why can't we do that in design or art?
Yeah.
Why can't we create artworks that borrow the responsibility of design, right? Or design works that borrow the existentialism of the arts. And suddenly the communication, the compositions are so much more richer and complex.
For sure. When you were studying with your father, was he exposing you to both of those worlds?
It was mostly the arts with him.
Yeah.
And actually, it's weird because I started, say, age 5, right? So I would be at the National Gallery in London, and my father would place me in a room filled with Turner's paintings. And he would be like, "Sebastian, go." And I would be supposed to look at all the paintings that were in the room, say 6 or 7 paintings, and try to identify which was the first painting chronologically.
Wow.
And which was the last. After that, I was supposed to identify within each painting, where did the artist start the painting? Where did the artist finish the painting? And then the third one was to try and establish where the artist was having trouble painting the painting. Where was he or she struggling? And I'm not saying I could answer these things at 5, but the fact that these were questions being asked was extremely interesting, because you start learning how to look at an artwork and understand how it's made, understand the process the artist went through when trying to compose it. And in a similar manner, when I would say make a drawing, and I was fortunate to be very good at it since a kid. So let's say I did a portrait of you and it has your proportions and your likeness. And I would be 9 years old, quite proud, because I'm drawing much better than all the other kids. And the kids come around and see, and they go like, "Wow, it actually looks like her." Well, then my dad would come and tell me off, because he would be, "Sebastian, how many times have I told you it's not good enough for it to look like someone? You've got to also now start checking when you mark a line and when you don't."
Mm.
It's as important the line that you draw as the line that you decide not to draw. Or every line is not the same. There are lines of different thickness and strength and marks. And so when you're being hammered all of this, these requisites since very young, it becomes interesting and eye-opening.
It's interesting that you just mentioned language, because, you know, at 5 years old, you haven't even really begun reading yet. And so it's incredible that you were learning the language of artists before you were even learning the written language of your country.
Yeah.
It makes sense then that you can speak it so well now.
Or I'm just aware of it. It's kind of like, again, the parallel with a kid learning to read music.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you see these little kids playing Bach or Beethoven, and they're doing an amazing work at something that is of a certain degree of complexity when they should be reading, I don't know, like children's books at the same time.
Right.
So I think I was very, very fortunate, and at the same time, burdened, maybe.
Right. I mean, those two do seem to come together quite frequently.
Yeah.
What did your mother do?
My mother was in another amazing part of the picture, because she was a kindergarten teacher with a lot of psychological studies, but maybe more importantly, was always a bit of a rebel.
Mm-hmm.
And so my father was the very anal, obsessive, imagine almost like a neurotic Woody Allen of the arts. And my mother instead was a kind of fuck the system person that was always the one telling me to stand up for my ideas. So it would be my mother that would say, if a kid punches you in school or teases you in school, punch him back, and punch him back hard. Or things like that. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
It was almost inverse roles.
Mm.
My father was the one who would cry.
Mm.
I've never heard my mother raise her voice in her entire life, or in my entire life, sorry.
Right. So there wasn't a lot of coddling on either side.
Yeah, but so very extreme opposite ends of the spectrum. I was remembering the other day that when we would go on vacation, the whole family would be inside the car, and it was almost like a family sport to point out the ugly monuments and how ugly they were and how much we despised them. It's the kind of weird thing that it became almost like a family hobby.
Wow.
Right? And I don't know. So then all those elements are just, they're there.
That's so interesting. Was your father crying over ugly monuments occasionally?
No. He was probably crying over amazing ones. So for example,
right.
My name is Juan Sebastian because of Bach, Johann Sebastian Bach.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw him cry conducting these imaginary orchestras many times.
Wow.
And so later on, when I was starting to do a little bit better, I would always save up a little bit of money, go to the subway where there was some classical musicians that would play on the side to make a little bit of money playing in the subway. And I would hire them and bring them for all of my openings. So whatever art opening I would have three dudes, I would ask them to put a suit on. And so my dad would always have Bach for him.
Wow.
And yeah. So dad was the weeper and mom was the more stoic and rebellious.
Do you think looking back, that's sort of informed your thoughts on gender roles at all? Or like, you know, accessibility to emotion, regardless of, you know, obviously we're going through so many changes around that right now anyway. But I'd be interesting to know, having grown up in that house, how that kind of informed your thoughts around this.
It's really interesting because on one side, I'm a Latin man, right? So I have the traditional gender roles very established. But on the other side, we had this enormous appreciation for the arts since kids. Mm. I remember it was, we're four brothers, so four boys. It couldn't be more testosterone-filled home as a kid. And I remember the four of us are watching Fight Club.
I love that film.
And we're sitting in my parents' bedroom because we only had one TV, and that's where the TV was. Each one of us had a pot of spaghetti. So it was manly enough that each one is with a pot, not a plate. So four dudes squished in with their pots of spaghetti, eating and watching Fight Club. And so Brad Pitt comes out and we go like, oh, that's a really cool fucking leather jacket, right? Yeah, that's a cool thing. And then it's like, that's a really good shirt. Yeah, I wish I had that shirt, yeah. And then Brad Pitt is shirtless, about to fight Norton. And we go, oh, that guy's pretty fucking perfect, right? Yeah. We're super gay, aren't we? Yeah, we're super gay. And it was like, it was just funny, right? Four dudes having an appreciation of how beautiful Brad Pitt's perfect body is in Fight Club, yet having to deal with what does this mean about us? I mean, right? So it's been interesting too in that sense. Today, I naturally feel quite conflicted with everything that's going on, mostly just worried about kids.
Yeah.
Right? It's like we've been extremely privileged as white men for a while, and it's fine if the pendulum goes a little far and we get a little bit more hurt. But it's hard to think of young boys not having a space, feeling they're accused of being guilty of everything just because of their gender or...
Mm. Yeah, and then you pile everything that's going on with the pandemic on top. It's a really difficult time to raise children. Do you have kids?
I don't.
Oh, okay. You don't have to tackle that right now. No, I don't either.
Not for now, yeah.
So you were spending time between Chile and London. If you look back kind of in how you turned out, what part of you do you think is British and what part is more Chilean?
It's interesting. I think the Brits are obviously very... They're quite formal sometimes, and there's certain conventions like being on time or being quite stoic, actually. I think probably because they were so bombed during the Second World War that in a way they developed this really thick skin, and it's almost looked down upon to complain too much. Mm. I think I got some of that, of incorporating the value of rigor and the value of stoicism. On the other end, I love that the South American culture is one of precarity and of exaggeration.
Yeah.
And so you learn to come up with solutions when there isn't a perfect fit for something. Mm. You learn to improvise. You learn to be more outspoken and more sensitive, maybe. And so it's an interesting two sides of a coin.
I'm thinking about that in relation to your work, and there's a balance in your work of that kind of like fixed, rigorous structure, and then also allowing space for the more natural world, which is maybe kind of representative of Latin cultures and the fact that things are a bit more fluid and a little more curvy and a little less hard lines and all of that. It's interesting that kind of shows up in your work as well.
Yeah, or there's the provoking nature or the humor. Mm-hmm. Where I'm jabbing a little constantly while still within very strict canons of aesthetics and so on. I don't know.
Yeah, which you might not have gotten away with if you were full British.
Probably. probably. Or otherwise, maybe I would have been too much of a mess if it was just the Latin flair and improvisation without the rigor.
Right. So then you studied design in Santiago.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
I didn't feel worthy of being an artist, really.
Hmm.
So I would prepare my father's slides for his classes since 14 or something. So I would make my allowance by filling in the different slides that he would be talking about in his class in school. So I felt that in a way I knew a big part of the curriculum of the arts program. And I wasn't sure if I had enough to say as an author. So I had the technique, I had the cultural understanding, but I wasn't sure I could call myself an artist. An artist is such a vain, weird, pretentious title. So I felt you needed to be able to own it if you were going to say it.
That's such a fascinating one. And that's come up multiple times, even just in doing this podcast. There was an amazing artist, Zoe Buckman, who was on, and she was talking about only feeling really comfortable calling herself an artist after she had a child.
Interesting.
And her thinking behind that was like, I've created, I now feel comfortable calling myself a creator because I've done it in this other way. And it is so interesting because there is a vanity attached to it. And yet I don't know if there's another career that holds that much stigma and just calling yourself the thing that you do.
Mm-hmm. I agree. It's interesting. I know Zoe and she's a force of nature. And
yeah.
I can understand how having a kid, then creating art is a continuation.
Mm-hmm.
I think on my end, I'm afraid of the opposite. I'm afraid the day I have a kid, it'll be so much more incredible than anything I could possibly make that I will lose a lot of the inspiration.
Interesting.
Keep pushing.
Hmm. Well, I guess you don't have a biological clock to contend with. You've got some time on your hands.
Sure. I guess we're lucky in that end. Yeah.
So what happened after you graduated?
So I graduated in Chile, and I've always been, since a kid, extremely aware of time, how fast time passes, and maybe trying to live life within a bigger macro set of values.
Yeah.
So I think we're taught to measure our satisfaction, our happiness, our return in relatively short bursts of immediacy. And for some weird reason, since I'm a kid, I try to think of life as a story you one day want to narrate, and you want to feel tranquil that it was a story worth living.
Mm.
And so the moment you have the sort of beginning and the end of the book as the format in which every decision is made, in which everything is done, suddenly they have another context, and suddenly you have much more resistance when the time is hard, or you don't care about things that aren't as important, or you have more balls to do something that maybe would feel scary within that day. It's not as scary within that year or within that decade, right? And so in a similar manner, I'm like, okay, I'm a designer, bit of an artist. The reality is that less than 1% of them gets to make a living from the work they do. And that's just the truth. Let's go see the stats. Let's see the numbers.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, the only way I can continue to be a professional artist and not an amateur, and the only way I can have a long life and a long career, is I need to be famous. I need to become a name. I need to get the respect of people.
Mm.
And so you start breaking things down. And it's like, okay, let's start with designer first. And I'm like, okay. And we didn't have any big designers back home in Chile, but we had very big architects. And there was an architect at the time that had a weekly column in the equivalent to New York Times of Chile. And I'm like, okay, well, I need a column. And so I'm 22 and I'm like, I need a column. And so it's like, okay, I'm a kid. No one's going to take me seriously. How do I convince the editor to give me a column? And then you continue the logic. So I arrived to the editor. I had won a few competitions. So I had a bit of a name, even though I was a kid, but basically I arrived with a presentation explaining the number of students in architecture versus in design, the availability of columns for one or the other, the 48 subjects I was going to touch in the year. I arrived with all of the images that I was going to be using so they wouldn't need to pay for external images. And I arrived with 16 columns pre-written, pre-edited, and pre-checked.
Wow.
And I tell her, look, here's 16. They go in a drawer for you. I start writing my first column tomorrow. If you don't like it, just find one of the 16s as backup and replace it. And I'll take whatever it is you're paying. And if you're not paying, I'll take it anyway. So when you do all that, you reduced any possibility this person had of saying no.
Yeah, pretty much.
Right? You offer a win-win. So I continued like that for everything. And super interesting because you go from the current culture, which is as much of asking. We're always asking for things. And you make a switch to offering. So I never ask for anything. I always offer something. And since the offering, I make sure to make it pretty good. You have much more chances of something happening. So by the time I was 26, I had my own TV show. I had a radio show. I had a newspaper column. And I was an advisor to the runner-up president of Chile for all of his campaign.
Wow.
And granted, it was a tiny country, so maybe it was easier to do it in a country of 17 million people. But there was a logic that you were understanding that it worked. It was like, okay, this shit makes sense. As long as I can always break down anything, this can continue.
Well, you were cutting your teeth for the New York University admission process.
Definitely, definitely.
Tell me about that.
That was amazing.
It's such an incredible story.
It was funny because same thing. I think sometimes when you're younger, you're also less aware of how crazy an idea might seem. You have less to risk, right? You don't know anything. And so I'm like, okay, I'm 26. Things are going pretty well in Chile. If I continue like this, I'll just make money and go for the house and the wife and the whatever. And I was like, I think I want to keep growing. I don't think I really know enough and I don't deserve this platform yet. It's like, okay, I've got to start again. And New York is the cultural capital of the world for me. So it's like, okay, I need a backup plan. I can't just try to write from zero. So it would be pretty good if I had a school for a couple of years. So I could be doing that while trying to understand how the game is played. And so getting into these schools is pretty hard, obviously. And so it's something like 2,000 people apply and 10 get in, for example, at NYU. And Columbia, it's crazy numbers. Bigger quantity of people getting in, but bigger people applying. So I just decided if I go the natural route, I'm going to be beaten by someone who has highest points. Mm-hmm. And they're not even going to get to open my folder.
Yeah.
Right? I won't have enough points in the first things and I'll just be eliminated by the computer. So I got on a plane, flew to New York, and I arrive at Columbia School of Art. I go to the dean's office. Secretary asked me what I was doing there. I'm here to see the dean. He's like, do you have an appointment? What's your name? And I'm like, no, I don't have an appointment, but I literally just flew from Chile. It's a 14-hour flight with a stop and I'm exhausted. So can I just wait over there in that sofa? It looks really comfortable. I mean, I'll wait whatever it is the entire day. I really don't care. And it was so quick. And while I'm doing this, I'm just sitting down that the poor secretary was like, okay. So she leaves me there. And I obviously had seen a photo of the dean. I knew what he looked like. And the dean is moving around in and out of his office. He's obviously informed that there's a student trying to wait for him. He blows me off initially and continues his day. And by then, hours start passing. And I always say it was like 8 hours, and it was probably more like 5, but it was still quite a while. And at some point, the dean wants to go home. And so this dude is still waiting for him. So he calls me in. And it's like, okay. So I get the interview with the dean. I arrive, I make a quick presentation, which I thought was good, but he didn't really look at it. And he goes, thank you so much, Sebastian. You're the spirit we want in the school. Listen, we want more people like you that are super animated and come here and fly over. You're exactly what Columbia is all about. Listen, I'm going to match you with one of our guiding senior students, and they're going to show you around, and then they're going to show you how to apply. And you're the spirit. Thank you so much for coming. And before he was pushing me out, I go like, thank you. But I wanted to ask you a question. This is why I came. He's like, sure, of course. And I'm like, listen, I was studying your program and I studied NYU's program. And I saw that you had these strengths, but you had all of these weaknesses, and you had these and these teachers, but they had so on. And so, listen, if I'm about to do this investment of 2 years, it's like, I really wanted to hear from you why I'm supposed to study with you guys and not with NYU. I mean, you have to tell me that the program seems a lot more compelling. Wouldn't you agree? And so the guy all of a sudden switches, starts selling me why I needed to be in school. And I'm being very polite, but still sticking to my points. And as it's going, he has to look at my work again and suddenly is kind of impressed and is in this selling mode. And long story short, I swear to God, he ends up offering me a scholarship. And that's one of those moments where I remember I like bit my tongue to like not laugh or say anything. And I go like, thank you so much for your offer. I mean, I'm incredibly touched. Listen, I already have an appointment tomorrow with NYU, so I will check up with them and I'll get back to you as soon as possible. But I'm incredibly humbled and this is amazing. I'm very excited. Thank you so much. I left and I was almost giggling with like, just, I couldn't believe it. And I went to NYU, same story. So I asked to see the head of art and they told me, do you have an appointment? I say, no, but I just got offered a scholarship at Columbia. And I wanted to see if you guys could top it. Passed immediately, sitting down, I get offered a better scholarship. And I went for NYU. And it's so funny because if I could do it again, I would go Columbia because I know it's a better school. Mm. At the time, I knew nothing. And NYU is just a nicer neighborhood in the East Village.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I want to study here. I don't know.
I lived a block from NYU for 4 years.
Amazing. It's just so nice, right?
Yeah, no, it's incredible. And you're in the heart of the city. So yeah. I'm sure for you moving to New York and learning about the city and all of that, it was an incredible experience.
It was just the best. I'm sure for you as a DJ, you're forced to do some of these roles too. It's like you're playing music, but you're also expected to look the part. And you're also expected to make whoever's event cooler. And then you're supposed to be nice to these people that want to be cool. And there's all these juggling acts, right?
There's an unexpected political quality to the arts, I think. There's like a part that always kind of makes me think of like court gestures back in the day, where you kind of have to have that ability to like relate to people, bring people into your world, make them want to be a part of it, but also kind of keep things light. And like you kind of think about, yeah, like gestures and Shakespearean plays who would kind of like insult the royalty a little bit, but not so much that they'd be beheaded and like all of that. And like listening to your admission story, there's a bit of that too, right? Like you have to kind of lovingly be challenging the status quo in order to obtain some level of acceptance and inclusion, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And we all want what we can't have. So there's such little tricks that the moment you understand that they just want to go home, they don't give a shit. And in this case, all of a sudden you can provide a situation where you seem like an attractive person that might go to the other competition.
And to go back to your earlier point, you're not asking for a scholarship, you're offering them you.
Exactly.
Lucky them.
Which, whether it was good enough or not, it's regardless of the fact that it was the only thing you were supposed to do.
It's funny that you mentioned that thing about kind of feeling like you came to New York with a sense of humility and a sense of wanting to learn more before you sort of arrived at the level that you'd already arrived at in Chile. And that is really rare. I find that it's sometimes hard to acknowledge and to act to create humility before life humbles us and kind of pushes us to that point, because we weren't kind of on top of it enough to ask for it and to act for it in a proactive way.
Yeah, it's very true. When I had my little bit of fame back home, and I would go to the supermarket and some old lady would come up to me and be like, oh, I love that design program you did about coffins and blah, blah, blah. It was very interesting to very quickly enter a bar, a supermarket, or a place and be recognized. And I had a bit of the high of that little initial fame that people all of a sudden goes up to your head and you think you're kind of great. So I kind of dealt with that quite quickly and got over it very quickly.
Yeah.
And so today I see people that get it for the first time and maybe it's more of a problem.
It doesn't add to your voice creatively mm-hmm. because you become, I think, too self-conscious.
Yeah. Yeah. And people, I think the older you are, if you arrive at fame older or a little bit of whatever it is, it's more hurtful for you in your career.
Yeah.
You make more of a fool of yourself. I don't know.
That's so interesting. So what were you making at this point once you got to New York?
So I had done several big public artworks at the time.
In Chile?
Yeah, in Chile.
Yeah.
The biggest one for me, favorite, was Chile had a dictator called General Pinochet.
Okay.
Equivalent of Franco or people of that character. And we had a lot of people imprisoned and tortured in the National Stadium. And for some reason, Chile had never dealt with that horrible legacy. And for some reason, I felt I had to take it on. And so I rented the stadium for a full week for myself. The stadium is, again, my parents are teachers. The stadium is expensive. I had to sell a lot of art and things and convince a lot of people to make that happen. But then managed to, after 2 years of permits, get a tree planted right in the middle of the stadium where you would normally start a match. And so the entire space is turned into a park, a memorial with this tree in the middle. We opened up the gates to the public. Anyone could walk in. You could have a picnic under the tree. You could sit down in the tranquility of a stadium. It's like the seats are so high that even though you're downtown, you don't hear a thing. Mm. So it's quite tranquil. And it was almost like a little island. And we finished that project with a soccer match played with Chile's national soccer team, the tree in the middle, and 40,000 people cheering and clapping. So it was like I had pulled off these quite complex and expensive projects. It's funny, I had zero money. It's like I was eating ramen noodles, but I had blown enough money and I bought myself a home in public artwork several times.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Were you doing any commissions at that point, or was it all about generating ideas and then figuring out how to make them happen?
On one side, I was doing these sort of design artworks that were mixing both languages. Instead of doing commissions, what I was doing was I would go to someone I knew who was relatively wealthy, and I would ask them to finance the production of a piece and tell them they could keep it if they paid for the costs, and that I would provide all of the receipts. Hmm. And I didn't want to be paid anything at all. But if they paid for its fabrication, they would own it and then they would allow me to exhibit it. And it became a way to finance production. Because again, I was offering. I wasn't asking, can you buy this? Or can you help me, the poor artist, fabricate my work? It was like, wouldn't you want to have one of the first artworks of a really driven kid just for the cost of fabrication? Mm-hmm. And my only request is to have it published and exhibited, which is only going to make it more valuable for you anyway.
Right.
And then I moved on to when that had worked, I was like going back to them and being like, okay, the deal changed. Now that I've got a bit of a name, we both own it. You pay the fabrication, we both own it. If it gets sold, we split 50-50. If not, you have the right to buy my half, or I have the right to buy your half. And so that's how I kickstarted fabrication of works.
Amazing.
So I arrived in New York with, I guess, a lot of experience for a 26-year-old. So I was doing giant public artworks. I was in communications and a variety of things. And it was weird to go back to being in school and being given homework and dealing with all that.
I'm sure. What is it, do you think, about New York that has kept you producing there since then?
I imagine for you too, you feel that once you arrive in New York, there's an energy and a pulse that is extremely intense and fast, mm-hmm. right? When we have friends over visiting, I don't know if it happened to you when you had people visit you from Canada that they walk so slow, right? And they're so annoying because you're like, come on, guys, like snap, snap, snap. We've got shit.
100%.
Right?
I know. I'm 5'11 too, so I walk mm-hmm. fast anyway. Yeah. But in New York, it was a completely different pace of pedestrian traffic.
Yeah.
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 For sure.
So I feel like that's just such a simple metaphor for the city in which everything is intense and all these sort of levers of your little whatever that equalizer thing is as a DJ, right? They're all up.
It's true.
All the volumes, everything is up, cranked up all the way.
It's true. Yeah.
And so it's hard when you get used to that speed.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to be tranquil at a lower rhythm.
Yeah.
It's almost addictive.
It's not almost addictive. It's definitely addictive.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I traveled all the time, so I had a really nice relationship kind of coming in and out, because it does, it feels like you're on a treadmill the whole time you're in New York.
Yeah.
I think sort of the dream for me would be to live between two places, one that kind of feels like inhaling and one that kind of feels like exhaling, one that feels like bringing in that information and energy and being inspired by it, but then also something that just allows for that tranquility, because it can run you ragged.
Yeah.
If you never break from it. I mean, you've gone back to the motherland. Is that for a bit of a...
There's a bunch of stuff I need to do here, and it just made sense. But it's interesting. There was a period I was going back and forth to Canada, or other periods I've been going to other places. And you're right. It's so nice to have the two sides of the coin. There's even a song that says, leave New York before it hardens you too much.
Yes.
And leave LA before it makes you too soft, or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think it's true. I'm starting to actually get a little afraid that I'm getting too tough in New York. And by tough, I mean more, not in a pretentious manner, I guess more like I've done so many tours of Iraq that after a while you start being slightly
desensitized.
Desensitized, yes.
Yeah, no, I wasn't planning on leaving.
Mm-hmm.
I walked out of my apartment flying to Paris and then just never ended up going back. So that has been a whole trip for me mentally. I'm having really interesting dreams about New York still. But I do think that you can learn a lot about yourself when you're in that mode, but you're not learning the full range of who you are, and you're not developing a full range of who you are. And when it comes to, you know, even you talking about your fear of having kids and losing some of that like energy towards your work, there's a part of me that thinks that that is the full spectrum of the human experience. And I have an apartment here now, but when I first came back and I was living with family again, it was a really big adjustment to go, my life isn't all about me right now.
Sure.
My life is about interacting with other people and making sure their day is going well and listening to their thoughts and their emotions around what they're experiencing. But you end up finding new sources of inspiration through that and tapping into different parts of who you are as a result. So it's interesting, because it doesn't necessarily feel like, in some ways it felt like a downward sort of gear shift.
Mm-hmm.
And then in others, it felt like it opened up this whole other spectrum of parts of myself that I needed to develop.
That's super interesting. I started seeing a psychologist about 2 months ago.
Okay.
It's an amazing woman. I love her. She's like 82.
Amazing. Where is she from?
She's actually Chilean. She's like,
okay,
extremely strong, stern, stoic, yet incredibly sweet lady that's like been around the block enough times. She's brilliant. And she's highly considered amongst her peers as almost someone with a genuine, unique talent to read people.
Mm.
And part of what we're working on is I was like, I need you to help me forgive myself more. I need you to help me relax the standards. I need you to help me chill.
Yeah.
I need you to help me relax the standards for other people.
Yeah.
And so when you're telling me about that connection with home, it's part of what I think I'm currently searching now in terms of, for her definition is like, you were a hypersensitive kid, that the only way you could learn to deal with this very vulnerable sensitivity that was absorbing so much data was to find these structures and discipline and rigor and so on. And so it's like trying to feel okay with your flaws, trying to feel okay with being okay.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. It's literally like being an addict or a war veteran or something, and you're trying to like, okay, we can do this.
It's a softening, I think. And in talking about your childhood and your relationship with your parents, it sounded like they're both extremely strong, but in being raised around three other boys and having a very stoic mom and a very rigorous, structured arts education laid out for you by your father, I'm sure that softness might not be something that comes easy. It doesn't come easy to me. Oh. So it's interesting just kind of seeing where it all comes from.
But I think that we both know the softness is there, right? Which is why we want to expose our vulnerable belly. And we know that's when you get to like feel the sun or on you, or I don't know, it's very cliche, but
no, there's so much strength in it.
Yeah, I don't need any more. I don't need any more challenges. It's like I'm as trained as I could possibly be. It's like, on the contrary, I need to now relax a bit more and enjoy things a bit more. I don't know.
And see the strength in that.
Yeah, yeah.
It is kind of funny. You get to a certain point, you've like done so much and lived so many lives, and then you kind of realize that the strongest thing is to be softer and vulnerable and allow for a little bit more balance within all of that.
Yeah.
So when you are in New York, what does a day look like for you? Are you pretty schedule oriented?
Super scheduled. Yeah. part of the whole thing.
Right.
It's funny because it's like I see everything as a rational paradigm that can be questioned. And so the moment I decide that, hey, the best thing I can do is eat six times a day, mostly protein and vegetables and blah, blah, it's incorporated into the structure and then that's it.
Right.
And so it's the same for everything. And that's all the way up to how to push creativity. People are always seeing me posting post-its or with tons of drawings, and it's everything is just finding new structured formulas that within the little trial and error scientific minded analysis, you're checking and feeling, okay, this is what works the best as a creative.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because most artists aren't structured, right? There's this myth of the artist as the hippie or the I don't know, the person from La Boheme, right?
Right.
This character of this opera that is just hanging around and needs to relax and chill to get inspiration.
Mm.
But when we think of anyone who is exceptional in any other field, the first thing we see that is that they're the hardest working at what they do. And they incorporate these strict structures that they've tried and tested and depured over time that allow them to do that thing they do so effortless. I feel there's no difference between being an artist or being a professional athlete in terms of dedication and rigor and systems.
What does that process look like for you, that creative process?
I mean, I wake up relatively early every morning. I don't have curtains on purpose. I try to wake up with normal light. I do 200 sit-ups and 100 push-ups, and then I get 2 cups of coffee and 6 eggs, 2 whites, 4 full eggs, 1/2 avocado, and a 1/2 tomato. That's waking up. right?
Your therapist is having a field day with this.
Yeah. And in the meantime, I'm listening to a podcast. I listen to them at 1.5 speed to incorporate more data in less time.
I do that too.
Right. I incorporate more of the informational ones and I leave the ones I love for the gym so that I have an incentive and I really want to listen to that new episode that came out, but I can't unless I'm at the gym. I try to review the day. I work a lot with, I work on many projects in parallel. So it's all about, I don't know if meditating, but calming your mind enough so that you can try and see the big pictures in each one of the different challenges and trying to understand all the priorities. And then meetings start at 9 with different people. And I'm seeing the results of works. I have people executing different ideas. It's almost as if you're playing a game of chess where you're making a move, but you've got to see multiple moves ahead of what the other person's going to do so that you can foresee trouble or problems or issues. And so you're playing almost multiple chess games in parallel. At some point around 11 or 12, I walk my dog. she's been trained to also only pee twice in the day because I'm so sorry, I love you, but like we can do more walks on the weekend maybe. Right? And if I'm not eating, you're not eating either. It's like,
oh my gosh.
If I'm busy, you're busy. It's like,
yeah.
It's funny because then, I don't know, there are other dogs that it's, they have all kinds of privileges here. It's like, well, if it's hard for me, it's hard for my dog, and we'll both be fine.
And then you create.
And then I create, and it, yeah, and it continues like that all day until, say, around six, there's certain periods where I try to socialize and
try
go to events and say hi to people, news and do all that.
Right.
And if there isn't a dinner, I'll go to the gym and then continue working and so on.
What does that space look like for you when you're creating? Is it quiet? Is it loud? Is it
very quiet? It's either completely quiet or I'm banging Metallica or Guns N' Roses into my ears, trying to get a pulse. It's interesting. I'm convinced you have stages for creation. So there's one part where you're just incorporating data and you're ruminating and you're processing unconsciously. But then there's deadlines and we're forced to get things to come out to certain deadlines so that you can then execute in time for a project.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've learned to do a couple of exercises to just almost give birth to an idea by force. That's where the strong music comes in. I've told this before, but I start banging the table. And it's like a constant pulse. Ask me why. I always relate it to sex in terms of like this weird accumulation of strength. And you're continuing. And it's almost like you're building energy to a point that it just has to at some point come, right? I have my head completely blocked off at the time. It's almost like you're meditating. And I'm not thinking on purpose. I'm just like accumulating almost anger and push. And ideas start coming out. And I start scribbling as fast as I can as the ideas come out. It's almost as if I'd say it's like a portal in a movie where they travel through time, where it always opens up for a little bit of time and then it closes. So you've got to pass through and get as much out of it as possible. I'm normally exhausted after it.
Creative climax.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the cliche of the medium. Again, in the movie, where the old lady that says, I feel an energy as your father. Does his name start with X? And then they're always exhausted. I always end up exhausted after this. And then it's interesting. I have some for really strong, that sort of I need to get the idea out. And there are some to get to higher degrees of sensitivity. And so that's when I'm like listening to Bach. And so now I'm blasting Bach and I'm trying to sort of get higher and like just try to grasp at that little higher note that I can't quite grasp. And I know I can go higher. I know it. It's like, come on, I need this sharper, sharper. It's like, I need to be more sublime. It's not good enough. And you start getting that. There's times I end up weeping. Just out, or not weeping, but like you have little tears crying out. It's just out of, it's almost like you're hyperventilating. And it's a weird yin and yang of sheer force output and then sharpening and like tweaking, toning. And that plus the constant process of accumulating enormous amount of info and strategy. And it's almost like a giant dance in which I'm trying to get my whole body to be as efficient as possible. And all of this is in 40 projects in parallel. And for every project, I accumulate before these periods enormous amounts of sketches and ideas and thoughts and lists. And so it's almost like you're a chef in a TV show and you're compiling all your knowledge of all these other similar dishes, plus you're getting all the ingredients. And then when you're there, it's like, okay, Metallica. And then it's like, you're trying to give the seasoning and you're like, okay, weep. I need to like, yeah, I don't know. It's I guess it sounds a little crazy when explained like that, but.
I mean, it doesn't sound more crazy than sitting in a bar smoking cigarettes and waiting for ideas to come.
Yeah, yeah.
Which projects have your attention right now?
I'm doing a giant platform within NFTs and the future of selling intellectual property. I don't want to tell you too much, but hopefully within two, 3 months, we'll be launching. I'm at a point in life where I've done most of the projects I ever wanted to do. And I'm still extremely interested in continuing my own body of work. But more than ever, I want to help others. I want to collaborate. I want to learn from others. And maybe the biggest quote-unquote artwork I could possibly do is now one that maybe allows others to be more efficient. If I had to be a hustler that needed to break down every situation and understand how to get doors open so I could finally show whatever talent I had, I would love to create a more efficient democratic system for others.
Yeah.
So that they don't maybe get too many doors shut on their face and quit, and we lose that talent that could have contributed just because they weren't as lucky to have this anal formation or delicate, or I don't know.
I caught a bit of your talk on Clubhouse on Everything Art School Won't Teach. Is that sort of the motivation of sharing some of those lessons?
Yeah, I think in general, people are very used to accepting the reality that they're given in life. And we tend to think and move within a small spectrum. And for whatever reason, I've trained myself or been trained since a kid to question everything and try and only incorporate that which makes sense and not accept anything that doesn't. So it's really the, what's that Socrates quote of a life unexamined is not a life worth living, mm-hmm. right? And so if I've had to go for an enormous amount of work and exhaustion training myself to do this, it's like, well, can I make this easier on other people? Why can't I use all my skills and the network and the credibility to now create a design that is not about me, but is about making these things easier for everyone else? I think that would be the ultimate artwork of sorts. I don't know.
For sure. And you seem to have, you know, mastered the business side of art in a very inventive way, which is not something that usually comes easily to artists.
Sure. I don't know if I've mastered the business side, because the worst thing any artist can do is to do a variety of different bodies of work and be interested in a variety of different fields and spread their time and interests in competing subjects that only make a collector more afraid, right? If you're a collector, you don't want an artist that's also a designer. You don't want an artist that's doing many different things. You want an artist that they tell you is obsessed with, say, bottles and recycling.
Right.
And that's what this artist does. They go out and they collect bottles from the beach and they're obsessed with that. And whenever you see a sculpture made of bottles,
it's easy to define.
Yeah, it's by this artist. And
right.
You have one in your home and everyone that enters your home can say, oh, you have one of the sculptures by the bottle artist. Good for you. Blah, blah. Right.
Yeah.
And you know, that's what this artist is going to do. And their incorporation into history will be the bottle artist. I know that works. That's not good enough for me. Not at a macro life. Not within an understanding that we change in life.
Yeah.
Right? If anyone told me they're only interested in bottles, they're either autistic and on the spectrum, which would be fine. Some of the most brilliant people are. Or you're lying.
Yeah.
And the reality is the vast majority of artists lie about this stuff. And it's understandable. It's hard to come up with a new idea, a new body of work. It's hard to risk your income to continue to be a purist. And so I feel I've managed to do well enough that I can have a small team and I can provide for them and myself while still doing everything I want to do, the way I want to do, and never compromising. So it's a different idea of success. I'd love to make more money, but I'm not willing to compromise.
Well, if it's not doing repetitious work, what do you believe art's contribution should be to society?
It's a really good question. This is where the being a kid, understanding the importance of life from a macro structure comes to play. If you're an artist, then you basically are telling the world that you're not going to follow a traditional role in which you contribute to the world through the normal means, but you're special, and that whatever it is you do requires the attention of everyone else because you're going to help us reflect our vulnerabilities and existentialism and everything that is so hard to put into words that defines humanity. It's like, well, fuck, you better be doing something that is really impressive, right? And the start to that should be, has it been done before? Is it complex and layered enough? Is it a true reflection of our times? How will this age? Is it honest? And those are all questions that I feel it's very hard for many works to answer. I sometimes make an analogy with music. You're the DJ, so I'm sure you incorporate all the time in your sets a whole bunch of one-hit wonders. And they're beautiful songs that I'm sure your crowd loves and cheers. And they're amazing. Yeah. But you don't take those musicians seriously.
Hmm.
Because they weren't capable of repeating creation again. They got to it once, mostly by luck.
Yeah.
Right? So within music, we understand the difference between a one-hit wonder and someone who's had a career reinventing themselves through multiple albums again and again and again. Now, that standard that we demand from music, we do not demand for the arts. And it's very interesting because it goes back to this idea that I believe the arts are measurable. The vast majority of people just haven't agreed on how to measure it, right? But they are as measurable as music because music is also an art. So if I go, okay, so why does that happen to us with music? Why can we identify a one-hit wonder in music? We can't identify a one-hit wonder in the arts. And I would say it's simply that we have been exposed to the language of music much more than we have been exposed to the language of art. If we did a study, 1,000 people over here, how many hours did you listen to music versus how many hours did you see visual arts? It's at least 10x.
Mm-hmm.
So like, of course, you can identify within music better what is good and what isn't.
Yeah.
Who has continued to develop multiple hits, maybe not one. So there's an entire education there that needs to be done. And if you're an artist trying to create something, I want to make 1,000 hits. I don't know. I mean, for every time you make a hit, it buys you life.
Hmm.
It buys me time. It says my life is worth living. If I just started repeating my same works again and again, after a while, I'm like, well, time is passing. From a macro standpoint, what did you do? What did you do from decade X to decade X when you were just doing variations of the same shit? What was your contribution?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's all these metrics coming in. For me as a kid, the best is Da Vinci, right? If you poll 1,000 art journalists or art critics and you lock them in a room and you say you can't leave the room until you've all decided who's the best artist in history, they could shout Picasso and Mondrian and blah, blah, and so on. And at some point, someone shouts Leonardo, and then the discussion should be over.
Well, he was a designer too, don't forget.
Right, and an engineer, and,
yeah,
and he was a chef, and an inventor. And I feel that that's when it gets interesting, when you think that Raphael, who's at the time, maybe was even better sculptor and better at drawing than Leonardo. But Leonardo was inventing new techniques. And when Leonardo was drawing, he was drawing to investigate the human body.
Mm.
While Raphael was decorating.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so when you decide, okay, I have one life, X amount of years, it's going to be measured in its satisfaction the day I die, not today, not tomorrow, not next week or next month. If I can be a 5% of Leonardo, that's so much better than getting to be a 60% of Kunz or whatever. Right. And so it's like, okay, it's much more ambitious and it's much harder to measure. And it's going to take more time. But if I can get there at the end of my life, it will be a life worth living.
Clearly, this young understanding of mortality has been an incredible driver for productivity. How would you describe your relationship with death?
It's today a very tranquil one. I'm fine dying today. I'm fine crossing the street. And if a truck kills me, it's like, I did everything I could. I killed myself. I never compromised. I never betrayed myself. I never chickened out. It's funny, I used to do one more hat of these. As a kid, I was around 14. I read that some guys I admired would review their day at the end of the day, try to visualize the entire day and see if it had been a good day or a bad day. And so I would get into a shower. I'll make myself like a little ball underneath the shower. And I would try to remember the day from the moment I had breakfast, took the bus to school, etc. There's only one question at the end of that. Was I brave today? And being brave meant standing up to a classmate or disagreeing with a teacher or simply doing what I thought was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And it was always yes. Then it was yes, even if it meant I got my face punched in or whatever. It wasn't always just easy. Around 24, I stopped doing it. It was 10 years of doing it. It's so ingrained. And so then that's why today I'm on the contrary. I'm trying to take the armor off. I'm trying to be more vulnerable. I'm trying to let those other parts arrive. I'm trying to lose the training.
I have a new one for you because I read this in an article and it was one of the cooler pieces of parenting advice that I've ever heard, but I feel like we could apply it to ourselves. There was this family and the parents go around every night with their kids and everyone has to say, how were you brave today? How were you kind today? And how did you fail today? And the parents do it, the kids do it, and the kids, through this process, normalize failure. They understand what it is to try something and not get it right the first time. And because they get to see their parents doing it, they laugh at their failures as adults. And it becomes this kind of thing where if you're not missing the mark, sometimes you're not shooting enough,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
And I've always kind of thought of that as a good way of measuring things that maybe feels a bit well-rounded.
It's true. I think we're very afraid of failing. And in a way, almost the school system is set up to protect you from failing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's like, if you follow the path and do what you're told, you will not fail. And you fail the most when you start questioning things. I just didn't want to fail my integrity. I think I've failed enormously many, many times, again and again. I didn't want to fail courage. And that's where maybe, again, the hack of thinking it from a macro perspective is almost like cheating, because it's easier to be ballsy if you're thinking of this moment now. What does this moment mean when I look back at it and I'm 90?
And what does that mean for your degree of presence in that moment? Like, you talk about this concept of aiming for tranquility, mm-hmm. rather than happiness or joy or
sure.
pleasure or
sure.
any of those things, which is kind of interesting because, like, do you feel like any of that is robbing you of the experience of the moment?
100%. 100%. And that's where the 82-year-old, the wise psychologist, has her part of her mission is to help me calm down and be, as opposed to just be analyzing. I had a previous psychologist before that I had to fire, because in 2 months, I was analyzing him.
Oh, I can totally see that.
Right? And it's
nothing
like,
about that is surprising.
Yeah, I am so insanely trained that I was telling him his issues with his mom, his father, and everything.
Yeah.
And it got to a point where the last session, he spoke the entire session. And that was my fault. I couldn't just be I couldn't just turn off my head and just be. And that's what I'm trying to learn, is trying to just be without reading. without processing.
Yeah, kind of hard to know how you can learn that with words.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess meditation helps a little. It's easier to be more tranquil when you've also quietened a lot of your inner demons or achieved a whole bunch of things you wanted to do.
I was so tranquil with the idea of dying like 2 years ago before the pandemic. I was like, I've kind of experienced so much. I had a conversation with my dad about that. I was like, if I died tomorrow, I'd be fine. I'd be so fulfilled. And then my slate got wiped clean and I started working and creating again from scratch. And now I feel like I have so much more to do. So it's cool that you're embarking on a new phase as well of helping other people, because I'm sure that that leaves a lot of unfinished business for you to keep working at.
Yeah, I have no intention of dying. It's more
running into traffic.
Yeah, it's more at times feeling almost ambivalent about being alive or not, but being very tranquil that if you do die, it's like, well, I don't have any more blood to give. It's like, there's nothing I didn't fucking do.
Do you feel like everyone knows how you feel about them? That's the one I always think about. Like, is there anyone who doesn't know exactly how much I love them?
Yeah, I think they do. Yeah, my parents, within their stoic ways, I feel like at the time, maybe I was the one that I managed to get these four brothers to hug and kiss, which was something that men in South America don't do. Or I used to go pick up my mom at school on Tuesdays and take her out for lunch. And one of the last times before I left on a trip, I was dropping her off back at school after we'd had lunch and so on. She loved it. I would arrive and the other teachers would be like, oh, your son, blah, blah, blah. And so she loved like the attention and then getting treated. And I'm dropping her off and I'm like, mom, we're going to do an exercise today. And she looks at me like, what do you mean? And I go like, you're going to give me a hug and you're going to say, my son, I love you very much. And my mom goes red. And she goes like, but why? And I go, because you've never said that, mom. Like, I know you love me, but like, you've never once said it. And so so I feel like that I've actually been the one, maybe because of the macro view, maybe because of the understanding that life is short, I've been the one saying, I love you, or I will not put up with this. And
yeah,
this is unfair, or you need to fix this, almost to a fault. I always get into trouble because I'm introduced to people at a bar and they tell me they want to be a pastry chef or a filmmaker. And I'm immediately breaking down all of their problems and the chances they have of being this, this, and that. And so I'm trying to genuinely help them become the filmmaker that they want to be, because I understand that most probably I'm going to see them in 5 more years and they'll have failed. And this is my way of showing love. But often people don't want to be told that, and they just want to have the story they tell, but they don't want to confront what it means to try and go for their dream. And I've had to learn to try and not say things, not help.
My best friend told me one time, I've known her since I was 5, and she was like, when something's going wrong for me, you're not my first call. My first call is like someone who just wants to wallow with me. You're my second call. She's like, you're my call when I need an action plan and I need to like dig myself out.
Yeah.
So I understand that. I feel like we're both working on softening.
But it's interesting because that's what, it's the cliche that girls tend to complain that when they tell their boyfriends problems, the boyfriends try to come up with solutions as a way to help, as opposed to just empathizing. So clearly you're more in our camp in terms of...
I'd make a really good boyfriend. Yeah, totally. Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time. I mean, I guess you're kind of stuck in the same room until Sunday, but lots of time for self-reflection.
Yeah, no, it's been amazing.
It's been wonderful. Really good.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for chatting with me. It was so great to connect.
Of course. Much luck. Take care.
You too.
Bye.
And that, beautiful people, concludes another episode of the Inspirati presented by Nuvo. Please rate and leave a comment if you're enjoying these conversations. You can follow The Inspirati and Nouveau Mag on Instagram or find me at alex.merrill. Stay inspired and keep creating.